Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, the journey of how one Midwestern woman became an Oklahoman. Susan Cates was a young academic when she was hired to teach at the University of Oklahoma. And over time, she came to appreciate the big skies, openness, and people of Oklahoma, thanks to a series of women from past and present. From the writings of Kate Barnard and Angie DeBow, Caroline Henderson, to the women she profiles in her book, Red Dirt Women, At Home on the Oklahoma Plains, Cates shares her own story and those of others who have inspired her and found their own interesting path in our state. The book is part personal memoir and personal essay, profiling barrel racers and bird watchers, casino queens and pioneer queens, as well as the birth mother of her adopted son and a particularly free-spirited preschool teacher. Susan Cates is an associate professor of English and Women's Study at the University of Oklahoma. Her book, Red Dirt Women, is published by the University of Oklahoma Press. Susan Cates, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, when I read the title, Red Dirt Women, At Home on the Oklahoma Plains, I first thought this was going to be about a variety of portraits of women here in the state, and it certainly is, but really the bigger story of this collection of essays, it's really a memoir of how an Ohio young academic became an Oklahoman.
Yes, it's very much my journey of coming to find a home in Oklahoma, which I make the point in the book is the only state in the Union with the word home in its name. But I realized, to me, it's both a book about Oklahoma women and my journey to making a home here that I feel I could not have made had I not come in contact with different cultures of women in Oklahoma.
Now, did the book start out being a memoir, or did it start out being these portraits of various women that sort of helped you become an Oklahoman? And because it's sort of a hybrid. In many ways, it's a memoir, but in many ways, it's also essay portrait sort of collection.
Well, I do love the personal essay, and I teach autobiographical writing at the University of Oklahoma. And as an academic, you know, I've written a scholarly book and scholarly articles. And one of the essays is about adopting our son, who's a native Oklahoman. And I really wanted to write a book that he would be able to read and be part of. He's in quite a number of the essays.
Yes, he is.
And so I didn't think that any of my academic work would appeal to him particularly or inspire him when he's older. And so I really wanted to write a book that he was part of. And as I was writing it, many times he was saying, Mama, why are you always taking me out into the middle of nowhere? But that's where a lot of the women that I talk about in the book live. So it really started to be a memoir. And then as I thought about how much I love the University of Oklahoma Press and I really wanted to send the manuscript there, I realized that, you know, the field of Western history is a fairly masculine one, mm-hmm. and that this book might have appeal in terms of the new Western history.
Yet, as you write in the introduction, we have all these incredible women Oklahoma writers, Kate Barnard, Angie DeBow, Wilma Mankiller, Lois Sipiel Fisher, and one that was new to me, Caroline Henderson, which I'm going to have to go read her now that I've read about her in your collection. Caroline Henderson was quite a spectacular Oklahoma woman, living in the Panhandle, writing about making a place for her family in the 19-teens or 20s?
She was there during the Dust Bowl.
Well, and she started writing about it prior to the Dust Bowl, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And I believe she went to Wellesley College. She went to a college on the East Coast, and she had these dreams of being kind of a frontierswoman. And so she went to Western Oklahoma as a single woman and married the man that was helping to help her dig a well, you know, and she was committed to that territory all her life and stayed there through some very hard times.
You say that those writers have inspired you. How in what ways did they inspire you?
Well, I think the minute I moved to Oklahoma, I started reading Oklahoma history because when I was a little girl, I had always dreamed that I was going to live in the West. And so when I came to Oklahoma, I made up my mind that it was the West, not the South. There's always that argument, is it the South?
Or the Midwest.
And to me, from where I came from in Ohio, it was very Western, especially if you drive to the Western part of the state. And the sky, the immensity of the sky to me was Western. And I began to read about women who made their homes here. And it's tough when you move anywhere, but I think I had never lived anywhere far from Ohio. And so when I came here in my early 30s to become a young assistant professor, you know, I had that kind of uprooted feeling of not knowing, you know, what was my sense of home going to be, because I didn't feel it was where I came from anymore. And yet at that point, I didn't feel it was Oklahoma. When I read about these women, their stories anchored me.
One of the things you write about is your own sort of journey to becoming an Oklahoman and how difficult that was. And a little later in the book, you write about a lot of your colleagues who have never lived anywhere near Oklahoma come to Oklahoma. It's just so different that a lot of them move on as soon as they can at the university.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I understand ecopsychology or ecopsychology. There have been a lot of studies about how people adjust to certain regions or feed off of certain kinds of geographies. I can completely understand why some people could come here and live here a number of years and never feel at home. I think oftentimes people from the West Coast and the East Coast have a particularly difficult time. But I came from Ohio, and I came from a place where there are vast amounts of periods where you do not see the sun. And so, to me, the weather and the sky were very attractive, and I wasn't coming from a place that was particularly cosmopolitan or near the ocean or with terrific weather. And so there was just so much that seemed adventurous about Oklahoma to me when I came here. Yet I can imagine living in, you know, a lot of urban places. Like, I don't know, a lot of my relatives are from around Philadelphia or Detroit. And, you know, I think that I would try to leave those places as quickly as I could, just because those aren't places that appeal to my central nervous system, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think we have deep kinds of issues within us that anchor us to certain places.
You certainly tell a lot of those stories in the new book, Red Dirt Women. And what was interesting is that there's a different tone in a number of these pieces. Some are almost journalism. Others are sort of personal memoir, but with a portrait of a person that's had some impact on your life. The very first story is one of the most poignant. It's the adoption story. It's the story of your adopted son and the story of your son's birth mother, Violet, who had one of those tough Oklahoma lives that we read about. It's unfortunately, it's the tough contemporary life with meth and all sorts of unhealthy relationships in her life. And yet she does this courageous thing of giving her second child up for adoption.
Mm-hmm. She's one of my favorite women for lots of reasons that you might imagine. I mean, when you're the beneficiary of a biological mother who gives her child to you, it's a tremendous thing. But she was a teenager, and she's no longer a teenager, but because my son is now 12 years old. But I always ventured out from the minute I moved here, but when we were on a quest to adopt our child, one of the points that she made was that she wanted to really get to know us. And she lived around Sulphur for some time, and so I would make biweekly treks there and to Shawnee after she moved there. And I really got to see, you know, other sides of Oklahoma and the kind of difficult lives that a lot of people lead in Oklahoma, because there is a lot of poverty in this state.
Yeah, and a lot of escapes from poverty as well, which Violet has been through.
Yes. You really get to see how completely different people are when they, you know, when they get off drugs. And lots of women are able to get off drugs while they're pregnant. And to my knowledge, she really tried to take care of herself because she really valued her pregnancy and the life of this child. But once he was born, you know, she went back to meth and, you know, has had a tough life ever since. It's very heartbreaking. And then you don't know as an adoptive parent how much you have played into that, you know, by virtue of the tough choices that she made to give you a child.
Yeah, that was a very poignant story. Other pieces are more journalistic, and one of the ones I really enjoyed was the story of the Queen of the Pioneer Outback is the name of the essay, and it's what is it? They're called the Frontier Queen, or?
Well, it's a long tradition that dates back to, I believe, the 30s or the 40s in Guymon, up in the Panhandle, one of my favorite regions of Oklahoma. And I found out that at the Pioneer Days Festival each year, they elect a woman who has always made her home in the Panhandle and has family roots that go back to settlement.
And it's called the Pioneer Days Queen. And each year it's an older lady who's lived her whole life there. And apparently this is like a very popular competition, if you will, or it's not really a competition as much as it's they name somebody and they honor them. And some really remarkable women, they meet up every year, all the former winners and that year's winner.
Yes, they have a luncheon, and I was invited to that luncheon, and I got to interview a number of the women. And it was very fortunate that another member of the community had videotaped other pioneer queens who really did live back to the time of settlement and through the Dust Bowl. And so I was able to hear a lot of those stories from women who had actually passed on. So I actually attended several luncheons and then got to watch this wonderful videotape. But these women had such incredible stories. And, you know, that part of me that would have liked to, you know, you always romanticize what it would be like to be in a desolate part of the West. But, you know, they told the downside and the upside, but the fact that they never left, it was very inspiring to me.
That's, I think, the really inspiring thing is these are all survivors. They survived the Dust Bowl. They survived watching, you know, their livelihood blow away. They survived watching their houses nearly destroyed, filled with dust, and yet survived and thrived.
Absolutely, and they have a good time. I will go up there and do a book signing. The festival is every year.
That's a part of the state you really love, the Panhandle, which even a lot of native Oklahomans don't necessarily share that love.
And I often find with my students, they've never been there. It's like an alien place, and I often find the attitude of the people who live in the Panhandle region. I think I compare it in the book to people who live in Alaska.
Right, you live in the lower 48.
You live in the lower 48. That's how they talk about the rest of the United States. Well, when I went up and spent a lot of time in the Panhandle, I would tell them where I was from, and they would say, oh, you're from downstate. And so there's kind of this psychology in the Panhandle inhabitants' mind that they're really separate from the rest of Oklahoma.
And in many ways they are. I mean, the distances are huge. You start out by writing about Woodward, which is sort of the gateway, and Woodward is probably a good 80 miles away from the Panhandle itself, or 60, 70 miles, and the next community is probably 70, 80 miles down the road.
Mm-hmm. Which is what appeals to me about that region, because even in Ohio, where I grew up and where there's lots of farmland, you're never far from, you know, it's still very populated. And so when I moved to Oklahoma, you know, I think the population, it's been almost 20 years ago, I think the population was a couple of million. And in Ohio, much smaller state, it was over 12, I think it was like 12.5 million. And so for me, the psychology of driving down a road in the middle of nowhere where there are just so few inhabitants, and so for such distance, there are so few inhabitants, was very comforting to me and peaceful, and I still love it for that reason.
You know, it's interesting, when you go to a place like Woodward, it's not uncommon for people to drive 50, 60, 70 miles to go to a McDonald's.
I know.
You'll be in the McDonald's.
And sometimes those are the very things I would like to escape, or at least in my romantic mind, I would like to escape. And so I think about how, you know, I've never lived anywhere like that for any period of time. I've always been the visitor. But I just have this way of romanticizing things that, were I to be in that situation, I might not find very romantic.
My guest today is Susan Cates, Associate Professor of English and Women's Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Red Dirt Women, At Home on the Oklahoma Plains. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press. It's part memoir, but it's also part character study of a number of people who've made a difference to her as she has adopted Oklahoma as her home place. And it includes cowgirls, barrel racers, women who work at a casino, the roller dolls who are reviving the old roller derby, as well as a great teacher that your son had in preschool who sounds like just this, an incredible teacher, Miss Dory. That's a wonderful little portrait that you wrote of her.
Oh,
absolutely, absolute free spirit, and what a great person to learn from.
You know, she's been such a gift to me because after we went through so much to get our son, it was very difficult for me to go back to work and leave him in a daycare center, and that's the kind of a 21st century conflict that a lot of parents have. And a lot of my colleagues and I used to talk a lot about daycare centers, and those from the East Coast and West Coast were very up to date on all these choices you would have in New York and California. And so this essay kind of grows out of the fact that we don't have a lot of the kinds of genres of daycare centers they have on the coast, but we have something that I think is a lot more special in teachers like Miss Dory.
There's also an essay about junking. You became a junker. Were you always a junker, or was that something you picked up in Oklahoma?
I've always been a junker, but what was intriguing to me when I moved to Oklahoma was suddenly I could see the difference between regional junk. For instance, I saw things when I came here. I would just head out to these little prairie towns on the weekends when my husband was watching football, and I would go, and suddenly I found different treasures than I found in Ohio. I found you could buy cowgirl boots, you could buy oil derrick lamps, you could buy ashtrays with petroleum companies' names on them.
And Frankoma pottery.
And Frankoma pottery, which I came to be an avid collector of that pottery. It's still one of my passions, and my husband always jokes that, or how well is this Frankoma pottery collection going to help our retirement? Because I seem to have a compulsion. I can't stop buying it, and it's all over my house. You know, one, the prairie green that was made famous by Martha Stewart when she did a piece on it in her magazine, and so it became more collectible. But the fact that Frankoma pottery was made in Oklahoma, and the maker and founder of Frankoma pottery himself was very interesting, has made it particularly esteemable to me.
Now, again, some of these are personal acquaintances in your life, like Miss Dory. Another essay was one of your colleagues at the university, Catherine Hobbs, who was an inveterate bird watcher. What was their feeling about your decision to write about them? Were they interested, puzzled? What exactly?
People had different responses. I think Dory, for example, was very thrilled to be profiled in my book and portrayed in my book, and she likes the essay very much. My friend Catherine is a little more of an introvert, and she kind of reluctantly, she read through the essay several times before she finally said, okay. But she never asked me to change anything, but I think people have different responses. Some people are more private than public.
Well, again, you're profiling a number of different people in Oklahoma, from the little ladies that survived the Dust Bowl in the Panhandle to the women that populate casinos in Oklahoma. I think that was an interesting statistic to me, is that women usually far outnumber men in most of the casinos, at least in your part of the state. And met some women who are working in a casino. And then, you know, Oklahoma is the state of immigrants. Even our Native American populations, most of them came from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And you profile perhaps our latest generation, and it's an amazing woman who lives in the Little Saigon section of Oklahoma City who escaped to Vietnam, a woman named Nung Le Nguyen, who runs a jewelry shop in Little Saigon.
Yeah, a lot of these essays speak to the kind of isolation that I felt when I first moved here, because I had one friend, Catherine, who would take me on bird walks. I moved into a department that was mostly men at the time when I came here almost 20 years ago. And so on the weekends, I was out looking at junk, or I was taking a bird walk with my friend Catherine, or I loved going up to the Asian district in Oklahoma City And I think that that was because I used to spend a lot more time up there. I think there was something in that kind of dislocation that comes, not that I can relate to what it's like to be an immigrant, but I felt a kind of kinship with people who had uprooted from somewhere else and learned to thrive in another place. And I also have a passion for jade. And so I was thrilled, and jade is something that you can't always buy in every city unless there is an Asian community. And so I, especially when I used to call Nung Le's store my personal Tiffany's. And there was something about when I was homesick or when I felt dislocated after I'd first moved here, I would go there and just stare at all the different shades of green jade. And there was something very comforting about that to me. And so for many years, we knew one another as merchant and customer. And then over the years, very slowly, we developed a friendship. And I've known her for a long time now. And she became a friend who shared her story, which is a true immigrant story of a boat person who fled Vietnam under terrible circumstances and came to the U.S. and managed to become a thriving jeweler. She was one of the first merchants in Little Saigon, or the Asian district, as we call it now.
Now, let me ask you, you've spent so much time with these women, you've written about them. What's your takeaway about Oklahoma women, red dirt women?
Well, the phrase red dirt has become so popular, and it's, you know, you'll hear about red dirt music. Mm-hmm. Someone told me there are red dirt women's clubs. I had never heard of that, and they told me that after my book came out. But it was one of the things that I really loved when I came here was the hue of the light on the red dirt. It makes afternoon sunlight different than it is in, I think, other parts of the country. And I don't know, a lot of the women that I have come to know are women who live well and live intensely and thrive here. And that's my aim, you know. I think a lot of people move place to place and they can always find something wrong with it. They don't like the politics, they don't like the weather, they don't like... And I think what I take away from a lot of the women that I've met that appear in the book, you know, they're just part, they're as much a part of the state as the character of the land. I think they're a version of the kinds of women who came here at the very first and survived. And they prove that Oklahoma is a place that you can make a wonderful home and where you can have a wonderful life.
Name of the book is Red Dirt Women at Home on the Oklahoma Plains. Susan Cates, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Susan Cates is an associate professor of English and Women's Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Red Dirt Women at Home on the Oklahoma Plains. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press. Well, today we welcome a new commentator to Studio Tulsa. Terry Simonson is a local attorney, former chief of staff for Mayor Dewey Bartlett, and a longtime political figure in our city. Today, he offers a few thoughts on the Improve Our Tulsa Capital Improvement Package.
This fall, when voters go to the polls to select Tulsa's next mayor and vote on our next capital improvements initiative, now called Improve Our Tulsa, these will be two decisions that will define our community for many years to come. The Capital Improvements Campaign is the largest in our city's history, over $918 million of improvements. Almost half of this money will be spent on street projects all over town, including street rehabilitation, bridge work, and engineering work. There will also be some street widening work, mostly for traffic congestion, on two-lane roads in South Tulsa. Funding for the street projects will be all wrapped into one single question on the ballot. In essence, we will vote for or against a property and sales tax levy to pay for the street projects. The other half of the capital improvement money will be spent on over a dozen different citywide projects. This is the part of the proposal where you will need a program in order to keep track of what projects are where and how much do they cost. It's even more important for citizens to keep on top of these projects because it appears that the city council is going to lump all of them into a single question on the ballot. So it's quite possible that the voters will not be able to pick and choose which projects they would support and pay for, and which projects they would not. In other words, take it all or leave it all. The larger projects of interest include a proposal to spend $15 million on a single stretch of Peoria Avenue for a bus service. The exact details, such as how many will ride the bus, what it will cost to operate the bus line, and what the return on this investment will be, have yet to be provided. There is $10 million for renovation to the downtown library. Here, the councilors will need to clarify why the capital improvements to the city-county library are only the responsibility of the citizens of Tulsa, not the citizens of Tulsa County. It is, after all, a city-county library system. There is $35 million for parks, $5 million for the Performing Arts Center, $9 million for Gilcrease Museum, $11 million for the zoo, and $11 million for river parks. Some on the council call these our nuts and bolts improvements. Others call these quality of life improvements. The final big pot of money is in equipment, and there is a lot of equipment to buy. Between the police and fire and information technology departments, the total is over $100 million. One could say, when looking at everything on the $900 million list, that this capital improvement proposal reflects the city doing a lot of catching up on things we have neglected to do and neglected to buy. The question for the citizens will be, do we play catch-up on all of these at once or over time? Now that the City Council has concluded its community meetings and called for the election, they have reached the point of no return, meaning that none of the projects included on the capital improvements proposal can be removed. It is now important for the citizens of Tulsa to become fully informed on the details of this proposal, the projects involved, and the cost of these projects. It has been represented that a portion of these projects will be paid for with property taxes, which will not increase, and a portion will be paid for with sales taxes, which will not increase. Typically, in such a situation, you would not expect any organized opposition if the projects merit community support. It is now up to our city leaders to make the case, a case that convinces the voters that the time has indeed arrived to improve our Tulsa.
Terry Simonson is a writer and attorney based here in Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just click on the website, find Studio Tulsa, and you can search our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.